Keter. Chapter 1.
Vehine behyot orhain sof nimshak. Bevihinat kav yashar tok hakalal hanis kalimala. Lo nimshak venit pashet tekef ad limata amnam hayamit pashet liat liat. Ritzone lomar, ke betikala hetkil kav haur lahit pashet visham tekif bitkalat hit pashtuto bisod kav. Nitpashet venemshak venaste, kain galgal ehad igul misaviv.
That was when I saw the pendulum. The sphere, hanging from a long wire set into the ceiling of the choir, swayed back and forth with isochronal majesty. I knew, but anyone could have sensed it in the magic of that serene breathing, that the period was governed by the square root of the length of the wire and by pi, that number which, however irrational to sublunar minds, through a higher rationality, binds the circumference and diameter of all possible circles. The time it took the sphere to swing from end to end was determined by an arcane conspiracy between the most timeless of measures. The singularity of the point of suspension, the duality of the plane's dimensions, the triadic beginning of pi, the secret quadratic nature of the root, and the unnumbered perfection of the circle itself. I also knew that a magnetic device centered in the floor beneath issued its command to a cylinder hidden in the heart of the sphere, thus assuring continual motion. This device, far from interfering with the law of the pendulum, in fact permitted its manifestation, for in a vacuum any object hanging from a weightless and unstretchable wire free of air resistance and friction will oscillate for eternity. The copper sphere gave off pale shifting glints as it was struck by the last rays of the sun that came through the great stained glass windows. Were its tip to graze, as it had in the past, a layer of damp sand spread on the floor of the choir, each swing would make a light furrow, and the furrows, changing direction imperceptibly, would widen to form a breach, a groove with radial symmetry, like the outline of a mandala, or pentaculum, a star, a mystic rose. No, more a tale recorded on an expanse of desert, in tracks left by countless caravans of nomads. A story of slow, millennial migrations, like those of the people of Atlantis when they left the continent of Mu and roamed, stubbornly, compactly, from Tasmania to Greenland, from Capricorn to Cancer, from Prince Edward Island to the Svalbard. The tip retraced, narrated anew in compressed time what they had done between one ice age and another, and perhaps were doing still, those couriers of the masters. Perhaps the tip grazed Agartha, the center of the world, as it journeyed from Samoa to Novaya Zemlya. And I sensed that a single pattern united Avalon, beyond the north wind, to the southern desert where lies the enigma of Ayers Rock. At that moment, at 4 in the afternoon of June 23rd, the pendulum was slowing at one end of its swing, then falling back lazily toward the center, regaining speed along the way, slashing confidently through the hidden parallelogram of forces that were its destiny. Had I remained there, despite the passage of the hours, to stare at that bird's head, that spear's tip, that obverse helmet, as it traced its diagonals in the void, grazing the opposing points of its astigmatic circumference, I would have fallen victim to an illusion, that the pendulum's plane of oscillation had gone full circle, had returned to its starting point in 32 hours, describing an ellipse that rotated around its center at a speed proportional to the sine of its latitude. What would its rotation have been had it hung instead from the dome of Solomon's temple? Perhaps the knights had tried it there too. Perhaps the solution, the final meaning, would have been no different. Perhaps the abbey church of Saint-Martin-des-Champs was the true temple. In any case, the experiment would work perfectly only at the pole, the one place where the pendulum, on the Earth's extended axis, would complete its cycle in 24 hours. But this deviation from the law, which the law took into account, this violation of the rule, did not make the marvel any less marvelous. I knew the Earth was rotating, and I with it, and Saint-Martin-des-Champs and all Paris with me, and that together we were rotating beneath the pendulum, whose own plane never changed direction, because up there, along the infinite extrapolation of its wire beyond the choir ceiling, up toward the most distant galaxies, lay the only fixed point in the universe, eternally unmoving. So it was not so much the Earth to which I addressed my gaze, but the heavens, where the mystery of absolute immobility was celebrated.
The pendulum told me that as everything moved, Earth, solar system, nebulae, and black holes, all the children of the great cosmic expanse, one single point stood still, a pivot, bolt, or hook around which the universe could move. And I was now taking part in that supreme experience. I, too, moved with the all, but I could see the one, the rock, the guarantee, the luminous mist that is not body, that has no shape, weight, quantity, or quality, that does not see or hear, that cannot be sensed, that is in no place, in no time, and is not soul, intelligence, imagination, opinion, number, order, or measure, neither darkness nor light, neither error nor truth. I was roused by a listless exchange between a boy who wore glasses and a girl who unfortunately did not. "It's Foucault's pendulum," he was saying, "first tried out in a cellar in 1851, then shown at the Observatoire and later under the dome of the Panthéon, with a wire 67 meters long and a sphere weighing 28 kilos. Since 1855 it's been here, in a smaller version, hanging from that hole in the middle of the rib." "What does it do, just hang there?" "It proves the rotation of the Earth. Since the point of suspension doesn't move..."
"Why doesn't it move?"
"Well, because a point, the central point, I mean the one right in the middle of all the points you see, it's a geometric point. You can't see it because it has no dimension, and if something has no dimension, it can't move, not right or left, not up or down. So it doesn't rotate with the Earth. You understand? It can't even rotate around itself. There is no itself."
"But the Earth turns."
"The Earth turns, but the point doesn't. That's how it is. Just take my word for it."
"I guess it's the pendulum's business."
"Idiot." Above her head was the only stable place in the cosmos, the only refuge from the damnation of the Pantarei, and she guessed it was the pendulum's business, not hers. A moment later the couple went off, he trained on some textbook that had blunted his capacity for wonder, she inert and insensitive to the thrill of the infinite, both oblivious of the awesomeness of their encounter, their first and last encounter, with the One, the Ein Sof, the Ineffable. How could you fail to kneel down before this altar of certitude? I watched with reverence and fear. In that instant I was convinced that Jacopo Belbo was right. What he told me about the pendulum I had attributed to aesthetic raving, to the shapeless cancer taking gradual shape in his soul, transforming the game into reality without his realizing it. But if he was right about the pendulum, perhaps all the rest was true as well. The plan, the universal plot. And in that case, I had been right to come here, on the eve of the summer solstice. Jacopo Belbo was not crazy. He had simply, through his game, hit upon the truth. But the fact is that it doesn't take long for the experience of the numinous to unhinge the mind. I tried then to shift my gaze. I followed the curve that rose from the capitals of the semicircle of columns and ran along the ribs of the vault toward the key, mirroring the mystery of the ogive, that supreme static hypocrisy which rests on an absence, making the columns believe that they are thrusting the great ribs upward and the ribs believe that they are holding the columns down, the vault being both all and nothing, at once cause and effect. But I realized that to neglect the pendulum that hung from the vault while admiring the vault itself was like becoming drunk at the stream instead of drinking at the source. The choir of Saint-Martin-des-Champs existed only so that by virtue of the law the pendulum could exist, and the pendulum existed so that the choir could exist. You cannot escape one infinite, I told myself, by fleeing to another. You cannot escape the revelation of the identical by taking refuge in the illusion of the multiple. Still unable to take my eyes from the key of the vault, I retreated step by step, for I had learned the path by heart in the few minutes I had been there. Great metal tortoises filed past me on either side, imposing enough to signal their presence at the corner of my eyes. I fell back along the nave toward the front entrance, and again those menacing prehistoric birds of wire and rotting canvas loomed over me, evil dragonflies that some secret power had hung from the ceiling of the nave. I saw them as sapiential metaphors, far more meaningful than their didactic pretext. A swarm of Jurassic insects and reptiles, allegory of the long terrestrial migrations the pendulum was tracing, aimed at me like angry archons with their long archaeopteryx beaks. The planes of Breguet, Blériot, Esnault, and the helicopter of Dufault. To enter the Conservatoire des Arts et Métiers in Paris, you first cross an 18th-century courtyard and step into an old abbey church, now part of a later complex, but originally part of a priory. You enter and are stunned by a conspiracy in which the sublime universe of heavenly ogives and the Thonian world of gas guzzlers are juxtaposed. On the floor stretches a line of vehicles, bicycles, horseless carriages, automobiles. From the ceiling hang planes. Some of the objects are intact, though peeling and corroded by time, and in the ambiguous mix of natural and electric light they seem covered by a patina, an old violin's varnish. Others are only skeletons or chassis, rods and cranks that threaten indescribable tortures. You picture yourself chained to a rack, something digging into your flesh until you confess. Beyond this sequence of antique machines, once mobile, now immobile, their souls rusted, mere specimens of the technological pride that is so keen to display them to the reverence of visitors, stands the choir, guarded on the left by a scale model of the Statue of Liberty Bartholdi designed for another world, and on the right by a statue of Pascal. Here the swaying pendulum is flanked by the nightmare of a deranged entomologist. Chelae, mandibles, antennae, proglottides and wings, a cemetery of mechanical corpses that look as if they might all start working again at any moment. Magnetos, monophase transformers, turbines, converters, steam engines, dynamos. In the rear, in the ambulatory beyond the pendulum, rest Assyrian idols and Chaldean, Carthaginian, great Baals whose bellies long ago glowed red hot, and Nuremberg maidens whose hearts still bristle with naked nails. These were once airplane engines. Now they form a horrid garland of simulacra that lie in adoration of the pendulum. It is as if the progeny of reason and the Enlightenment had been condemned to stand guard forever over the ultimate symbol of tradition and wisdom. The bored tourists who pay their 9 francs at the desk or are admitted free on Sundays may believe that elderly 19th-century gentlemen, beards yellowed by nicotine, collars rumpled and greasy, black cravats and frock coats smelling of snuff, fingers stained with acid, their minds acid with professional jealousy, farcical ghosts who called one another cher maître, place these exhibits here out of a virtuous desire to educate and amuse the bourgeois and the radical taxpayers, and to celebrate the magnificent march of progress. But no, Saint-Martin-des-Champs had been conceived first as a priory and only later as a revolutionary museum and compendium of arcane knowledge. The planes, those self-propelled machines, those electromagnetic skeletons, were carrying on a dialogue whose script still escaped me. The catalogue hypocritically informed me that this worthy undertaking had been conceived by the gentlemen of the convention, who wanted to offer the masses an accessible shrine of all the arts and trades. But how could I believe that when the words used to describe the project were the very same Francis Bacon had used to describe the House of Solomon in his New Atlantis? Was it possible that only I, along with Jacopo Belbo and Dio Talevi, had guessed the truth? Perhaps I would have my answer that night. I had to find a way to remain in the museum past closing and wait here for midnight. How would they get in? I had no idea. Some passageway in the network of the Paris sewers might connect the museum to another point in the city, perhaps near Port Saint-Denis. But I was certain that if I left, I would not be able to find that route back in. I had to hide somewhere in the building. I tried to shake off the spell of the place and look at the nave with cold eyes. It was not an epiphany now I was seeking, but information. I imagined that in the other halls it would be difficult to escape the notice of the guards, who made the rounds at closing time, checking to see that no thief was lurking somewhere. The nave, however, crammed with vehicles, was the ideal place to settle in for the night as a passenger, a live man hiding inside a lifeless vehicle. We had played too many games for me not to try this one, too. Take heart, I said to myself. Don't think of wisdom now. Ask the help of science. Chapter 2. We have divers curious clocks, and other like motions of return.
We have also houses of deceits of the senses, where we represent all manner of feats of juggling, false apparitions, impostures, and illusions. These are, my son, the riches of Solomon's house.
Francis Bacon, The New Atlantis, Editor Raleigh, London, 1627, pages 41-42. I gained control of my nerves, my imagination. I had to play this ironically, as I had been playing it until a few days before, not letting myself become involved. I was in a museum and had to be dramatically clever and clear-headed. I looked at the now familiar planes above me. I could climb into the fuselage of a biplane to await the night as if I were flying over the Channel, anticipating the Legion of Honor. The names of the automobiles on the ground had an affectionately nostalgic ring. The 1932 Hispano-Suiza was handsome, welcoming, but too close to the front desk. I might have slipped past the attendant if I had turned up in plus-fours and Norfolk jacket, stepping aside for a lady in a cream-colored suit with a long scarf wound around her slender neck, a cloche pulled over her bobbed hair. The 1931 Citroën C64 was shown only in cross-section, an excellent educational display but a ridiculous hiding place. Cugnot's enormous steam automobile, all boiler or cauldron, was out of the question. I looked to the right, where velocipedes with huge Art Nouveau wheels and draisines with their flat scooter-like bars evoked gentlemen in stovepipe hats, knights of progress pedaling through the Bois de Boulogne. Across from the velocipedes were cars with bodies intact, ample receptacles. Perhaps not the 1945 Panhard Dinavia, too open and narrow in its aerodynamic sleekness, but the tall 1909 Peugeot, an attic, a boudoir, was definitely worth considering. Once I was inside, deep in its leather divan, no one would suspect a thing. But the car would not be easy to get into. One of the guards was sitting on a bench directly opposite, his back to the bicycles. I pictured myself stepping onto the running board, clumsy in my fur-collared coat, while he, calves sheathed in leather leggings, doffed his visored cap and obsequiously opened the door. I concentrated for a moment on the 12-passenger Obéissante, 1872, the first French vehicle with gears. If the Peugeot was an apartment, this was a building, but there was no hope of boarding it without attracting everyone's attention. Difficult to hide when the hiding places are pictures at an exhibition. I crossed the hall again, and there was the Statue of Liberty, Éclairant le Monde, from a pedestal at least 2 meters high in the shape of a prow with a sharp beak. Inside the pedestal was a kind of sentry box from which you could look through a porthole at a diorama of New York Harbor. A good observation point at midnight, because through the darkness it would be possible to see into the choir to the left and the nave to the right, your back protected by a great stone statue of Graham, which faced other corridors from the transept where it stood. In daylight, however, you could look into the sentry box from outside, and once the visitors were gone, a guard would probably make a routine check and peer in, just to be on the safe side. I didn't have much time. They closed at 5:30. I took another quick look at the ambulatory. None of the engines would serve the purpose, nor would the great ship machinery on the right, relics of some Lusitania engulfed by the waves, nor Lenoir's immense gas engine with its variety of cogwheels. In fact, now that the light was fading, watery through the gray window panes, I felt fear again at the prospect of hiding among these animals, for I dreaded seeing them come to life in the darkness, reborn in the shadows in the glow of my flashlight. I dreaded their panting, their heavy telluric breath, skinless bones, viscera creaking and fetid with black-greased drool. How could I endure in the midst of that foul concatenation of diesel genitals and turbine-driven vaginas, the inorganic throats that once had flamed, steamed, and hissed, and might again that very night? Or maybe they would buzz like stag beetles, or chirr like cicadas amid those skeletal incarnations of pure, abstract functionality. Automata able to crush, saw, shift, brake, slice, accelerate, ram, and gulp fuel, their cylinders sobbing. Or they would jerk like sinister marionettes, making drums turn, converting frequencies, transforming energies, spinning flywheels. How could I fight them if they came after me, instigated by the masters of the world, who used them as proof? Useless devices, idols only of the bosses of the lower universe, of the error of creation. I had to leave, get away. This was madness.
I was falling into the same trap, the same game that had driven Jacopo Belbo out of his mind. I, the doubter. I don't know if I did the right thing 2 nights ago, hiding in that museum. If I hadn't, I would know the beginning of the story but not the end. Nor would I be here now, alone on this hill, while dogs bark in the distance, in the valley below, as I wonder, was that really the end, or is the end yet to come? I decided to move on. I abandoned the chapel, turned left at the statue of Graham, and entered a gallery. It was the railroad section, and the multicolored model locomotives and cars looked like reassuring playthings out of a toyland, Madurodom, or Disney World. By now I had grown accustomed to alternating surges of anxiety and self-confidence, terror and skepticism. Is that perhaps how illness starts? And I told myself that the things seen in the church upset me because I was there under the spell of Jacopo Belbo's writings, writings I had used so many tricks to decipher, even though I knew they were all inventions. This was a museum of technology, after all. You're in a museum of technology, I told myself, an honest place, a little dull perhaps, but the dead here are harmless. You know what museums are. No one's ever been devoured by the Mona Lisa, an androgynous Medusa only for aesthetes. And you are even less likely to be devoured by Watt's engine, a bugbear only for Ossianic and Neo-Gothic gentlemen, a pathetic compromise, really, between function and Corinthian elegance, handle and capital, boiler and column, wheel and tympanum. Jacopo Belbo, though he was far away, was trying to draw me into the hallucinations that had undone him. You must behave like a scientist, I told myself. A volcanologist does not burn like Empedocles. Fraser did not flee, hounded into the wood of Nemi. Come, you're supposed to be Sam Spade. Exploring the mean streets, that's your job. The woman who catches you has to die in the end, and if possible, by your own hand. So long, Emily, it was great while it lasted, but you were a robot. You had no heart. The transportation section happened to be right next to the Lavoisier atrium, facing a grand stairway that led to the upper floor. The arrangement of glass cases along the sides, the alchemical altar in the center, the liturgy of a civilized 18th-century Macumba. This was not accidental, but symbolic, a stratagem. First, all those mirrors. Whenever you see a mirror, it's only human, you want to look at yourself. But here you can't. You look at the position in space where the mirror will say, you are here, and you are you. You look, craning, twisting, but nothing works. Because Lavoisier's mirrors, whether concave or convex, disappoint you, mock you. You step back, find yourself for a moment, but move a little and are lost. This catoptric theater was contrived to take away your identity and make you feel unsure not only of yourself, but also of the very objects standing between you and the mirrors, as if to say, you are not the pendulum or even near it. And you feel uncertain, not only about yourself, but also about the objects set there between you and another mirror. Granted, physics can explain how and why a concave mirror collects the light from an object, in this case, an alembic in a copper holder, then returns the rays in such a way that you see the object not within the mirror, but outside it, ghost-like, upside down in midair, and if you shift even slightly, the image, evanescent, disappears. Then, suddenly, I saw myself upside down in a mirror. Intolerable. What was Lavoisier trying to say, and what were the designers of the conservatoire hinting at? We've known about the magic of mirrors since the Middle Ages, since Alhazen. Was it worth the trouble of going through the Encyclopédie, the Enlightenment, and the Revolution, to be able to state that merely curving a mirror's surface can plunge a man into an imagined world? For that matter, a normal mirror, too, is an illusion. Consider the individual looking back at you, condemned to perpetual left-handedness, every morning when you shave. Was it worth the trouble of setting up this hall just to tell us this? Or is the message really that we should look at everything in a different way, including the glass cases and the instruments that supposedly celebrate the birth of physics and enlightened chemistry? A copper mask for protection in calcination experiments. Hard to believe that the gentleman with the candles under the glass bell actually wore that thing that looks like a sewer rat's head or a space invader's helmet just to avoid irritating his eyes. Quelle délicatesse, Monsieur Lavoisier! If you really wanted to study the kinetic theory of gases, why did you reconstruct so painstakingly the eolipile, a little spouted sphere that, when heated, spins, spewing steam. A device first built by Herod in the days of the Gnostics to assist the speaking statues and other wonders of the Egyptian priests. And what about this contraption for the study of necrotic fermentation, 1781? A fine allusion, really, to the putrid, reeking bastards of the Demiurge. A series of glass tubes that connect two ampules and lead through a bubble uterus, through spheres and conduits perched on forked pins, to transmit an essence to coils that spill into the void. Balnea Marii, sublimination of hydrargyrum, mysterium conjunctionis, the elixir. Or this apparatus for the study of the fermentation of wine, a maze of crystal arches leading from Athanor to Athanor, from alembic to alembic. Those little spectacles, the tiny hourglass, the electroscope, the lens. Or the laboratory knife that looks like a cuneiform character, the spatula with the release lever, the glass blade, and the tiny 3-centimeter clay crucible for making a gnome-size homunculus, infinitesimal womb for the most minuscule clonings. Or the acajou boxes, filled with little white packets like a village apothecary's cachets, wrapped in parchment covered with untranslatable ciphers, with mineral specimens that in reality are fragments of the holy shroud of Basilides, reliquaries containing the foreskin of Hermes Trismegistus, or the long thin upholsterer's hammer, a gavel for opening a brief judgment day, an auction of quintessences to be held among the elves of Avalon, or the delightful little apparatus for analyzing the combustion of oil, and the glass globules arrayed like quatrefoil petals, with other quatrefoils connected by golden tubes, and quatrefoils attached to other crystal tubes leading first to a copper cylinder, then to the golden glass cylinder below it, then to other tubes, lower still, pendulous appendages, testicles, glands, goiters, crests. This is modern chemistry. For this, the author had to be guillotined, though truly nothing is created or destroyed? Or was he killed to silence what his fraud revealed? The Salle Lavoisier in the Conservatoire is actually a confession in code, and an emblem of the whole museum, for it mocks the arrogance of the Age of Reason, and murmurs of other mysteries. Jacopo Belbo was reasonably right. Reason was wrong. I had to hurry. Time was pressing now. I walked past the meter, the kilogram, the other measures, all false guarantees. I had learned from Allier that the secret of the pyramids is revealed if you don't calculate in meters but in ancient cubits. Then the counting machines that proclaimed the triumph of the quantitative but in truth pointed to the occult qualities of numbers, a return to the roots of the notaricon the rabbis carried with them as they fled through the plains of Europe. Astronomy and clocks and robots. Dangerous to linger among these new revelations. I was penetrating to the heart of a secret message in the form of a rationalist theatrum. But I had to hurry. Later, between closing time and midnight, I could explore them, objects that in the slanted light of sunset assumed their true aspect, symbols, not instruments. I went upstairs, walked through the halls of the crafts, of energy, electricity. No place to hide here, not in these cases. I began to guess their meaning, but suddenly I was gripped by the fear that there would not be time to find a place from which I could witness the nocturnal revelation of their secret purpose. Now I moved like a man pursued, pursued by the clock, by the ghastly advance of numbers. The earth turned inexorably, the hour was approaching. In a little while I would be kicked out. Crossing the exhibit of electrical devices, I came to the hall of glass. By what logic had they decided that the most advanced and expensive gadgetry of the modern mind should be followed by a section devoted to an art known to the Phoenicians thousands of years ago? A jumble of a room, Chinese porcelain alongside androgynous vases of Lalique, potteries, majolica, faience, and Murano, and, in an enormous case in the rear, life-size and three-dimensional, a lion attacked by a serpent. The apparent reason for this piece was its medium, that it was made entirely of glass. But there had to be a deeper reason. Where had I seen this figure before? Then I remembered that the Demiurge, Yaldabaoth, the first Archon, odious creation of Sophia, who was responsible for the world and its fatal flaw, had the form of a serpent and of a lion, and that his eyes cast fire. Perhaps the whole conservatoire was an image of the vile process by which,
through the eons, the fullness of the first principle, the pendulum, and the splendor of the pleroma give way, by which the Ogdoades crumbles and evil rules in the cosmic realm. If so, then the serpent and lion were telling me that my initiatory journey, au revoir, alas, was already over, and that soon I would see the world anew, not as it should be, but as it is. Near a window in the right-hand corner, I noticed the sentry box of the periscope. I entered it and found myself facing a glass plate, as on the bridge of a ship, and through it I saw shifting images of a film, blurred, a scene of a city. What I saw was projected from a screen above my head, where everything was upside down, and this second screen was the eyepiece, as it were, of a primitive periscope made of two packing cases arranged in an obtuse angle. The longer case stuck out like a pipe from the cubicle above and behind me, reaching a higher window, from which a set of wide-angle lenses gathered the light from outside. Calculating the route I had followed coming up here, I realized that the periscope gave me a view of the outside, as if I were looking through a window in the upper part of the apse of Saint Martin, as if I were swaying there with the pendulum, like a hanged man, taking his last look. After my eyes adjusted to the pale scene, I could make out Rue Vaucanson, which the choir overlooked, and Rue Conté on a line with the nave. Rue Conté split into Rue Montgolfier to the left and Rue de Tourbigot to the right. There were a couple of bars at the corners, Le Weekend and La Rotonde, and opposite them a façade with a sign that I could just barely discern, Les Créations Jacques-Sam. The periscope. There was no real reason it should be in the hall of glass rather than in the hall of optical instruments, but obviously it was important for this particular view of the outside to be in this particular place. But important how? Why should this cubicle, so positivist scientific, a thing out of Verne, stand beside the emblematic lion and serpent? In any case, if I had the strength and the courage to stay here for another half hour or so, the night watchman might not see me. And so I remained underwater for what seemed a very long time. I heard the footsteps of the last of the visitors, then the footsteps of the last guards. I was tempted to crouch under the bridge to elude a possible random glance inside, but decided against it. If they discovered me standing, I could pretend I was an enthusiast who had lingered to enjoy the marvel. Later, the lights went out, and the hall was shrouded in semi-darkness. But the cubicle seemed less dark now, illuminated as it was by the screen. I stared steadily at it, my last contact with the world. The best course was to stay on my feet. If my feet ached too much, then in a crouch, for at least 2 hours. Closing time for visitors was not the same as quitting time for the employees. I was seized by sudden fear. Suppose the cleaning staff started going through all the rooms, inch by inch. But then I remembered. The museum opened late in the morning, so the cleaners probably worked by daylight and not in the evening. And that must have been the case, at least in the upper rooms, because I heard no one else pass by, only distant voices and an occasional louder sound, perhaps of doors closing. I stood still. There would be plenty of time for me to get back to the church between 10 and 11, or even later. The masters would not come until close to midnight. A group of young people emerged from La Rotonde. A girl walked along Rue Conté and turned into Rue Montgolfier. Not a very busy neighborhood. Would I be able to hold out, watching the humdrum world behind my back for hours on end? Shouldn't I try to guess the secret of the periscope's location here? I felt the need to urinate. Ignore it, a nervous reaction. So many things run through your mind when you're hiding alone inside a periscope. This must be how a stowaway feels, concealed in a ship's hold, emigrating to some far-off land. To the Statue of Liberty, in fact, with the diorama of New York. I might grow drowsy, doze. Maybe that would be good. No, then I might wake up too late. The worst would be an anxiety attack. You are certain then that in a moment you will start screaming. Periscope, submarine, trapped on the ocean floor. Maybe the great black fish of the abyss are already circling you unseen, and all you know is that you're running out of air. I took several deep breaths. Concentrate. The only thing you can rely on at a time like this is the laundry list. Stick to facts, causes, effects. I am here for this reason, and also for this reason, and this. Memories, distinct, precise, orderly, of the past 3 frantic days, of the past 2 years, and the 40-year-old memories I found when I broke into Jacopo Belbo's electronic brain. I am remembering now, as I remembered then, in order to make sense out of the chaos of that misguided creation of ours. Now, as then, while I waited in the periscope, I shrink into one remote corner of my mind to draw from it a story, such as the pendulum. Dio Talevi told me that the first sephira is Keter, the crown, the beginning, the primal void. In the beginning he created a point which became thought, where all the figures were drawn. He was and was not, he was encompassed in the name yet not encompassed in the name, having as yet no name other than the desire to be called by a name. He traced signs in the air, a dark light leapt from his most secret depth, like a colorless mist that gives form to formlessness, and as the mist spread a burst of flames took shape in its center, and the flames streamed down to illuminate the lower Sephirot, and down, down to the kingdom. But perhaps in that Simsun, that diminishment, that lonely separation, Dio Talevi said, there was already the promise of the return.